And it is time for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. One thing we've noticed about running a monthly media segment in 2018 is that the topics come fast and furious. We can try to lock up the topics a few days in advance, but the fire hose of news frequently shuffles our deck right up until the last minute. Happened again today as we're walking in. Andrew said, Did you see this? But that's okay. There's always plenty to talk about. And we do define media very broadly, taking in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. Our regular guests are here, Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi from the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
I guess we should start with Facebook. And, of course, Facebook's founder would not have been before first a Senate and then a House committee on successive days if it hadn't been for the whole Cambridge Analytica taking 87 million Facebook users' worth of data up there. But we were talking actually about some of the world perceptions of Facebook, too, because it sounds like, from all accounts I've heard of the Senate hearing, and I didn't get a chance to see much of it, that the members of the Senate were not exactly up on Facebook.
No, I think that they were interested in it, and they wanted to get as much information as they could out of Mark Zuckerberg, and they almost seemed pretty excited to talk to him. One of the underlying type of themes, though, that I feel is connected is back in 2013, I went to Philadelphia and I listened to Speaker Barton Gellman. He was one of the people that Edward Snowden contacted when he was coming out with his information. And a line that Barton Gellman, who was a journalist for The Washington Post, said that I think just sticks with me all the time when I think about Facebook and social media and all the different apps that we use on our mobile devices, is that your mobile phone is a microphone that could be turned on at any time in terms of all these things that we're posting intentionally, but also not intentionally, whether it's just tracking all of the phone calls that you make. If there's that type of data, people could see, oh, okay, well, this person works at this time and this person goes to sleep around this time. So I always remember and think of that. Line that your phone is a microphone that could be turned on into the world at any time, and any of this information can be released.
That is a good point, and I remember a couple of months ago when my then new phone said, is it okay if we record your stuff when we're getting your information from Google? Record? No. Ever since then, I can't use the voice feature on that part of the phone.
Yeah, our lives are wonderful. You know, everything is incredible that we have these amazing technologies today. But, you know, if we described our day-to-day life to someone, you know, a few decades ago, they'd say, wait, I read this dystopian novel. You know, it's true. We are willingly, and in fact, that was one of the really funny jokes I saw about this hearing. Someone was sort of parodying a senator and saying, Mr. Zuckerberg, you've managed to get, you surveil all Americans and give them and let them do it, willingly, and they don't protest you. How did you pull it off? I think it was a very interesting hearing to see one. Obviously, all the senators and congressmen, I saw more of the Senate hearing than the congressional side, the House side, but it was clear they all wanted to look very tough on privacy, but it also was pretty clear that most of them didn't really understand the topics at all. They seemed very out of touch and really confused as to how Facebook works, but even more so just the internet in general. These are complex issues. I mean, to be fair, I don't think that necessarily every, you know, 20-something user of social media knows these things either. But, you know, I think in some cases, kind of looking at Mark Zuckerberg's face, you could kind of just tell, like, how exhausted he was having to, in some cases, explain really simple things. I think one of the great lines was, you know, one of the senators asked, you know, how are you able to keep this free? And his answer was, Senator, we sell ads. It's like, this is a great soundbite. But yeah, I mean, I think it's troubling. I mean, I know many people who have after the Cambridge Analytica story came out have started to pull back from their Facebook use. You know, some people have said, I'm off, I'm done. You reach me on Instagram, which is funny because they own Facebook owns Instagram.
Yeah.
But
and WhatsApp.
Yeah, exactly. And others are just saying, you know, I have to use Facebook for networking purposes, but you know, none of you will see anything personal here anymore.
One thing that I would suggest, you know, I saw a lot of the similar posts of people saying they wanted to pull back. But one thing I do suggest for everyone that uses Facebook is to go through the different apps that are on Facebook, because sometimes when you take silly quizzes or you do those little photo features, that it's putting an app into your Facebook account. And I always try and do it every couple months, because I'm always surprised mm-hmm. how many silly apps I got myself to put into my Facebook or connect with my right. Facebook account. And those are the things that could kind of be a little dangerous.
Right. So what's this when you want to take the quiz and find out, you know, which house at Hogwarts you're in? You know, you give access to them to your
sure.
data to do that.
Yeah.
So you have to remember to be like, oh, who did I let in? You know, I had one friend who deleted his Facebook account and then immediately started a new one. But what he said is, you know, and it was interesting, he was posting about his experience that because he was now only going to comment on, like, things that he was very intentional about, and he was talking about how for days he's like, I have seen nothing but my friends in my feed. I haven't seen any news stories. I haven't seen anything. And he was really excited. I was kind of tempted just to start tagging brands in this just to mess with them.
But you know, one of the really interesting things is the fact that Facebook does look different to everyone. I mean, because mm-hmm. what the preferences you indicate makes your news feed look different from every other person on the planet. But in the same way, people tended to look at the Zuckerberg testimony through their own lenses too. You know, the people who study government are thinking, well, is there going to be regulation on Facebook? The business pages are talking in terms of, well, Zuckerberg zoomed Facebook's valuation by about $5 billion by appearing before Congress. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody's got their own little way to view the world, and Facebook tends to magnify that.
Yeah, they do. And I think, you know, a lot of the analysis of it that I've read has basically said that Zuckerberg won this round with Congress, that actually it helped more than anything. You know, Congress more or less was asking Zuckerberg to tell them how to create privacy policy, which is exactly what Facebook wants, right? They want to be their own regulators. Yeah. And so, you know, I think that this is going to be something that will sort of and mostly kind of blow over for a period of time. It's going to keep coming back. You know, privacy issues and our digital rights are going to keep coming back and haunting us.
And not to be too much of a communication professor on the radio, but it is important to remind people of Raymond Williams. He's a theorist, and he said that people will use technologies in ways that we never intended for it to be used. So that's what happens, I think, with social media, apps, technology, that it could be used in all kinds of ways. So sometimes we try and be proactive, but a lot of times we're also reactive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange. Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University with us. If you want to join the discussion on the exchange, you're welcome to come in at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to talk about the Sinclair promo copy. So the Sinclair stations, the TV stations, there are 193 Sinclair TV stations, not all of them, I think, doing local news, but their local anchors were given copy from the home office in Baltimore to read. You know, for example, we're concerned about the troubling trend of irresponsible one-sided news stories plaguing our country. The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories that just aren't true without checking facts first. It was pointed out to me that if you just look at the copy without knowing where it came from, it's actually fairly straightforward. The issue, again, comes from the source, though, and when Sinclair forces its stations to run the Boris Epstein commentaries, the Bottom Line with Boris, and the Terrorism Update Center, or what I still don't have the name right. I'm sorry about that. But so when their general gist seems to be a little more toward the right, when they put this copy out, it sounds like it's supporting a Trumpian point of view.
Yeah, especially in context of, you know, what the president is constantly tweeting, right? And I think when we see that the dominant discourse about this fake news issue is not about people who are literally creating fake stories, which is a real problem and is ongoing. That's where the conversation of fake news began back at in 2016, and immediately Trump somewhat kind of brilliantly co-opted that phrase and applied it to all media that was unpleasant for him. And so I think when you read, yeah, in a completely, you know, if we just read it in a time capsule 100 years from now, we'd be like, oh, well, this is well-written piece. But within the context of everything that's going on and who it's coming from, it's disturbing. And I think it's disturbing when you watch, you know, the really great video that's out there where someone has edited all these little clips together. And you know, I shared it and said, you know, we are the Borg, resistance is futile, because there's all these voices in unison saying the exact same message. And again, I think people think of their local media as local. They think of like, oh, I can go to this trusted local source that's going to give me a local perspective on what's happening in my community. And all of a sudden you realize, oh no, there's these sort of corporate overlords who are telling them what they have to do. And the other thing that came out, of course, is the contracts that Sinclair reporters and anchors are bound to, which is really doesn't allow them a lot of leeway to get out of this. If they don't want to do it, they're kind of screwed.
Truly. And that also brings up the other issue with Sinclair Broadcasting right now, which is they are at the ownership cap. So with their 193 TV stations, they reach 39% of the American population. Yeah. If they are allowed to buy Tribune Media, that will be 72%. And yeah, the FCC is considering the ownership cap at the moment.
I wish I wrote down the figure, but I also just read a figure about the number of job openings in broadcasting that are the percentage that are Sinclair, and it's very high. I mean, it's if you want a job in this industry, you're more likely than not to get one in at a Sinclair station.
Let's move on to somewhat older media from TV and talk about the Denver Post, because this is a really interesting case where the editorials in the Denver Post last weekend, were editorials slamming the owners of the Denver Post, which is an unusual move. But it included a picture, and it was all about the fact that the new owners or the current owners are cost cutters. And so the picture that went with the editorial was a picture of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for the Post in 2013 for the coverage of the Aurora Theater Massacre. And 75% roughly of the people in the picture were blacked out because they had left the Denver Post.
Yeah, I think that photo or that image was really affected me when I saw that, because you can see visually who's no longer part of that team. And also, I really admired them for being courageous and speaking out, because they're in communications and they're in journalism, and that's what we, you know, that is our ethics of being able to give a certain type of voice. So they are speaking out and having their own personal voice. And it could be really difficult when you're in it, when it's your job and your livelihood, to think of going against the person that the hand that feeds you. But I definitely admire that.
Yeah, I mean, we know that probably a lot of newspapers, if not most, in the country could probably run similar photographs, right? And so I thought it was a phenomenal act of kind of just social courage. I mean, I think this is a conversation we need to be having about the importance of journalism. And, you know, if ever there was a time where we needed more people on the ground asking tough questions, it's now. And yet in community after community, newsrooms are shrinking. And that's just really scary to me.
Well, at the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, we interviewed one of their writers who wrote a book about a man who was a news photographer, but also was spying for the FBI on the civil rights movement in the 60s. But he mentioned that when he got to the newsroom at the Commercial Appeal, it was about 220 people. Now it's about 40 on the editorial side. So things are shrinking. We're talking about the Media Matters here on the Jefferson Exchange on our Signals and Noise segment with Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University. Your thoughts welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to talk a little bit about the Laura Ingraham boycott, because Laura Ingraham's got what was it called? The Ingraham Angle on Fox News in the evening. So one of the primetime shows there. Criticized one of the high school kids, was mocking David Hogg for his writing about the colleges that didn't accept him, and got a lot of blowback from him and from people who like him. She did apologize. But then there was a boycott against Fox News because of it. And then when she took what it was apparently a scheduled vacation, there was like, look, we drove her away for a week. So sometimes the people in the who are talking about the news become a bigger story than the news itself.
And she did lose a lot of advertisers over that.
Yeah, and it's not the first time she's ever said anything controversial. And she said things about LGBT communities and people of different ethnicities. But I think it is going back to that idea that you have this microphone on, this type of microphone out into the public, and sometimes your message becomes louder at certain points, and other times sometimes people say things that it just doesn't disseminate or have as like a significant of an impact. But this one definitely did because of social media and the age group and the context of political and current events surrounding the timing of her statements.
Well, the Parkland students from Florida seem to be having just an ongoing effect in several realms. I mean, the media, one of them, obviously, but the fact that we are having discussions about gun control in America, and serious ones, it seems like, for the first time in years, where we don't just have politicians saying, no, you can't do that. I mean, Florida, of all places, passing further gun control restrictions in the state legislature is a big change. Mm-hmm. And the students have brought a lot of this about, but they also get this media backlash from the right wing. There was another commentator, Jamie Allman, who was working for the Sinclair, the Sinclair station in St. Louis, talked about wanting to jam a hot poker up. Mm-hmm. We'll leave it to the imagination of the audience. And he ended up quitting from his job.
Yeah.
A little too far.
I mean, there's been just a kind of an organized effort to discredit these students, to bash them, to basically tell them to shut up. It's fascinating to me. I give them a lot of credit for them keeping and keeping up their work and pushing forward. I think, again, these are kids and they're not always media savvy. They're like, give them a lot of credit. They're very media savvy, but they make mistakes. They sometimes, in fact, there's, I think, a CNN interview where the anchor had to correct an incorrect data point that that David Hogg gave. They're going to make mistakes. They're human. They're learning. But they've been mostly very effective, and it gives me a lot of hope for sort of the kind of effective student that might be coming forward as college professors is something I think we're excited about.
Well, I wonder in your classes, Precious, if the students are inspired by what they see as the media savvy of David Hogg and his friends from Parkland.
Yeah, I think that in 2018, we definitely see a different reception of young people than we might have in like the 1980s or 1990s or even early 2000, where people, they can make a social and cultural difference based upon what they're putting on social media and all of their different outlets. And then just to see the articulate speakers that have come out of the different shootings and how they speak against gun violence, that can't help but be inspirational to see someone your age or even someone younger making such a huge impact and not backing down to these adults that could be very intimidating or different mainstream media that could be trying to intimidate or discourage some of their voices.
I have to chuckle a little bit, though, because I don't know if you saw this or not, but one of our students went viral this week.
Yes.
On Twitter because
the cougar thing.
SOU sent out a notice saying that there's been cougar sightings near campus, and a student responded to the entire campus, and all students
got this email.
Reply all that said, "Oh, that's just my mom," and a student I know, that student I've had in a class, retweet. Or shared that on Twitter, and it got hundreds of thousands of retweets. And so she's like emailing me like, I don't know what to do. BuzzFeed's calling me.
Yeah, it is a BuzzFeed article now.
So, yeah, yes, our students might change the world, or they might just make us famous for cougars.
two senses of the term cougar, yeah, right. We have about 3 minutes left. Do you guys want to go straight to pick three, or do you want to talk about one of this morning's breakers?
And we can do pick three.
Yeah.
All right. Give me some time for this change.
Yeah.
Andrew and I, we talked about doing a pick three for the Ashland Independent Film Festival, which is really taking off today and all the way through Monday. So the films I'm super excited about seeing are Liana, animated film that takes place in Swaziland. Mm-hmm. Also, Minding the Gap. I was a teenager in the 90s, so I love skateboarding videos and anything related to skateboarding, and that's a film that incorporates that. And then also The Tuba to Cuba. I can't turn my back away from anything about Cuba. I've always found books, films, everything, music about Cuba to be so fascinating.
And you've been to Cuba, haven't you?
Yes, I have, but shh.
not cool now. you mentioned a little bit about Liana and Mind of the Gap. What is Tuba to Cuba about?
I'm not exactly sure yet, but it has all those things I'm interested in: music, Cuba, culture.
Well, it's a group of New Orleans jazz musicians who travel to Cuba to see the roots of their music. So that's as much as I know about. I'm seeing it today, actually.
Since the secret is out that I've been to Cuba now, I will say that when I did go to Cuba, there's so many financial restraints that people have. Even when it comes to food, they're given rations and all of the cars are old. But one thing that there's so much passion and people feel, I saw that people feel unrestricted by is music. So I'm excited about that.
Okay. And Andrew, you have a pick three also for the festival?
Yeah, I do. I'm one of the programmers of the film festival. So two are films I've seen, and one is one I actually haven't, because there's so many films that come through that I don't actually get to see them all. One is Fort Maria, which is a film that I saw and recommended to be in the festival. And it's hard to even explain what it's about, but it's a narrative feature about a woman who can't leave her home for agoraphobia. Actually, both of these have agoraphobia as a theme. The next one is People, which is about a YouTuber who can't leave her home. And I guess that's just basically, I hate leaving my home. People, I think is a film that especially like younger people will really enjoy. It is, it's a kind of a romantic comedy, micro budget. Most of the film only has two actors, but so it's about this YouTube star who has a crush on the delivery boy who comes and brings her food. Really cute movie. And then last one is Lynn Shelton's Outside In. Lynn Shelton is a favorite director of mine. She's probably most known for Your Sister's Sister. So she is bringing her new film that she co-wrote with Jay Duplass, who is probably best known for being an actor on Transparent. And Edie Falco's in that as well. And that'll be at the Ashland Armory. And she will be here to do a Q&A and a discussion about the film.
Okay. All kinds of big stuff coming up at the Ashland Independent Film Festival. In fact, you are sandwiched between segments about films at the festival. We talked about I Am Maris in the first part of the 8 o'clock hour. We'll be talking to the folks from Intelligent Lives in number two coming up. So you'll probably pass Chris Cooper.
We're excited to have him.
Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi are on the communication faculty at Southern Oregon University and are monthly experts for the Signals and Noise Media segment. Always good to have you guys here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.